This is XTP Media.
You're listening to Extended. Here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 73 of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Now, today's episode is a slightly self-indulgent episode for me. I'm here on my own listening to the interviews that we've recorded about the Fairey Barracuda. Now, this all started 7 or 8 years ago when I had the opportunity to do an interview with my father, who was, of course, a telegraphist air gunner and flew in the Fairey Barracuda. That started my interest, and I managed to connect up with Matt Willis, the naval air historian. Ever since then, he's been writing the definitive book on the Fairey Barracuda, which was published earlier this year. Now, I got to catch up with Matt at the Yeovilton Air Show. We were in the restoration hangar of the Fleet Air Arm Museum, overlooking their restoration of DP-872, which, of course, will be, once it's restored, the only complete airframe of a Fairey Barracuda. Now, the Barracuda was the Royal Navy Fleet Air Arm's most heavily produced aircraft of all time. And as I've mentioned, there is no single airframe left, which is very sad. So it's pretty difficult to find out about the aircraft. So let's start off by talking to Matt about his book, and he tells us all about the aircraft. So I'm in the Fleet Air Arm Museum, and I'm in a very special place, which we'll come back to in a short time. But I've got a very familiar voice. It's Matt Willis. Matt, welcome back.
Hi, Peter.
Thanks for coming back onto the show. Today we're going to talk about the your book, about the Barracuda. We've mentioned it a few times whilst you were writing it, but we've never really talked about the book itself. It's been published. I've got a copy. I've read it end to end. Let's talk about the aircraft from the beginning. Where did the concept for the Barracuda come from?
Well, the concept was to replace aircraft such as the Fairey Swordfish, which at the time had only been in service for about a year. For a long time, the Fleet Air Arm had been pursuing this very incremental evolution of biplane torpedo aircraft. The Barracuda was a big step forward, and it was to be the first monoplane torpedo bomber in the Fleet Air Arm inventory. It was to perform several functions, so it was to be a reconnaissance aircraft and a dive bomber as well as a torpedo bomber, and it was to make use of more modern concepts, more modern construction techniques and tactics and equipment that was coming along in the late 30s and early 40s.
And in the book you talk a lot about the development phases of it. It was quite a tricky development, quite prolonged in some aspects. Finally getting the aircraft into service, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a very tortuous development. It started off being designed for a Rolls-Royce engine called the Boreas, or the X, which was actually cancelled so Rolls-Royce could build more Merlins. Yeah. It was changed to a Merlin, which required making quite a lot of changes to the aircraft itself. It was then progress of the aircraft was held up as a result of the Battle of Britain, the need to build more fighter aircraft and to divert more resources to RAF aircraft, so it was held up in that respect. And then when it continued development, There were various problems, such as increasing weight of equipment meant that the aircraft then needed a more powerful engine, and it was because it was late coming into service, there were limits to what they could do to fix these problems.
Yeah.
So they were constantly sort of one, two steps behind, chasing themselves when it came to actually getting the aircraft into service and trying to make it into an effective, usable, safe aeroplane for Fleet Air Arm crews to use.
Yeah, and I think, you know, Monday morning quarterback stuff, looking back, some of those challenges were real and they were desperate, and the Navy needed a lot to be done, but the reality was the war was going on and the aircraft were needed quickly. How quickly did it get into production?
Well, it started in production in around 1942. The first squadrons were formed the first squadrons were formed sort of towards the end of that year, and it first went into operational service in September 1943. But bear in mind, this is now nearly 6 years after the original specification was issued, and a couple of years after the aircraft had first flown. Other developments that I didn't mention actually was that it needed a redesigned tail. It needed a completely different configuration of tail because of buffeting when the air brakes were down. So it did take a while. It took a while to develop it. But again, as I said, there was a limit to the amount they could do with the basic aeroplane. They couldn't make particularly drastic changes once production had started because they needed these aircraft, as you pointed out. They were, you know, into the third, fourth year of war with biplane, canvas-covered biplane torpedo aircraft, and they really needed something more modern and high performance to do the job, and also a mass-produced aircraft to equip the very expanding Fleet Air Arm at the time. So it was there was this sort of race against time to try and get it into production, and as a result, when it appeared, there were accidents, there were crashes, there were structural failures, and once again there was this sort of one step forward, two steps back issue with the development of it.
And there is a perception, both from some of those who flew in the aircraft, but also from others around and about, it received some pretty bad publicity. But some of those so-called design flaws were, I suppose, at the time, were part and parcel of a testing process they didn't have time to execute.
Yes, and I think there are some issues that perhaps need to be separated, and which sometimes got conflated, particularly in the minds of the crews, which was that some of them were switching from these very tractable, very easy to fly biplanes into a modern high performance monoplane with much higher wing loading, much higher performance. You know, deck landing, it was a different matter, so some of those issues would have perhaps been there with any comparable aircraft. In some respects, though, there were other things that did need to be fixed. And part of the problem is, if an aircraft fails catastrophically and crashes, you have no information as to what happened about it. So that gave the test pilots at the factories difficulties then, and the Royal Aircraft Establishment, the Aeroplane and Armament Experimental Establishment were both roped in with the factory test pilots to try and find out what was going on with the aircraft. And Winkle Brown was involved in this process, and more or less did the whole test flying establishment relating to the Barracuda was really focused on this for some time.
And it went into production, and we talked about it being a high production aircraft. We were just chatting earlier. It was the highest produced aircraft for the Fleet Air Arm in the Second World War, but you were saying actually of all time.
I believe that's the case, yeah. There were over 2,500 of them built. This was at a time when the Fleet Air Arm was expanding dramatically. When you compare it to the previous dedicated dive bomber that the Fleet Air Arm had in service, the Blackburn Skua, there were 190 of those built. There were 2,500 Barracudas. Yeah. And then after the war, the service shrunk again. So really, there was that one small period. And the next highest aircraft produced, which was the Ferry Swordfish, was actually in production from 1936 through to 1944, I think. Yeah. Whereas the Barracuda, was its main production period was 42 to 45.
Yeah.
So a much shorter period, but reflecting that mass production.
But split across several factories as well. It wasn't just produced by Ferry, was it?
No, there were four companies involved in the production at any one time. This being to ensure that if one factory was seriously damaged, the production of the aircraft, the delivery of the aircraft would continue. And the idea was that everything was done, the production was done, and the jigs were all the same at all the factories, the processes were the same at all the factories. So theoretically, if you had a bit of Barracuda built in one factory, it would fit a bit of Barracuda built in another factory. Now, I understand from the restoration team that that's not actually how it worked in practice, as perhaps you can understand.
Yeah.
They were building these aircraft quickly. They were built to be, you know, put together quickly and put out into service and expected to have a relatively short life. So, but that production group was very important to the nature of the Barracuda, that it was built by these separate companies in theoretically exactly the same way.
Right. So let's talk about the aircraft in service. What sort of service life did it have?
First operational use that the aircraft saw was in the Mediterranean. A squadron of Barracudas went out with the invasion fleet for the invasion of Italy at the end of September 1943. And the idea was that they would be facing the Italian fleet that was expected to be trying to stop the invasion fleet. They would be fulfilling their design role as a torpedo bomber to confront the Italian fleet, which actually surrendered just before they were able to do this. So actually, the only contact that the Barracudas had with the Italian fleet was to provide top cover to escort them to Malta to surrender. So they were, in actual fact, protecting them from the German attacks, because they feared that the Germans would then attack the Italian fleet to deny them to the Allies. But that's another story. In the actual operational service that they saw, other than that, was as anti-submarine, in the anti-submarine role, which was actually something that was quite important to the Barracuda overall, as the nature of the war changed.
Then they went on to go and see service in predominantly home fleet type environment, didn't it?
Well, two theatres really, the home fleet in the North Sea and the East Indies and into the Far East a little bit. But in early 1944, the big task for the Navy in home waters was dealing with the Tirpitz, a very powerful battleship which the mere presence of provided a huge threat to the convoys, providing material to Russia and the Atlantic convoys. So the Navy staged several very coordinated, very highly resourced raids, the first of which was Operation Tungsten, using Barracudas to try and put the Tirpitz out of action. And they used 600-pound armour-piercing bombs. The Barracuda was actually the first Fleet Air Arm aircraft that could lift this bomb, and it was capable of steep dive bombing to strike at the Tirpitz where it was hidden in its Norwegian fjord with high mountains either side of it. Very difficult place to get into a strike, impossible to use torpedoes. Operation Tungsten was a big success. They scored numerous hits with the 1,600-pound bombs and the smaller bombs, which did serious damage to the battleship, and also caused a lot of damage to the upper works and the anti-aircraft weaponry, and put her out of service for 3 months, which when you're running convoys, 3 months is worth an awful lot. They did try further raids. Those were less successful. They did actually score one more serious hit with a 1,600 pound bomb, which penetrated right through the armour and into the lower spaces of the ship. But it didn't explode. Right. The Germans later said that if that bomb had exploded, it would have potentially sunk the ship and certainly would have done very, very serious damage.
But the Barracuda was a workhorse as well for the fleet air arm, wasn't it? It went on to equip many, many squadrons, both at home in Europe and in the Pacific as well later on in the war.
Yeah, quite a few squadrons went out to the East Indies to try and strike at Japanese targets in places like the Andaman Islands, Nicobar Islands, Java, Sumatra, and so on and so forth. And they did, again, mainly dive bombing attacks on shore targets such as a cement factory, which was important for the Japanese building reinforcing defences and ports. So they attacked ships in ports and airfields and oil storage tanks and things like that, and actually did a lot of damage in that phase of the war. Again, similar sort of time to the Tirpitz raids, the sort of spring and summer of 1944. So the fleet air arm was expanding, lots of new squadrons were being formed, being trained up in Scotland and Northern Ireland, and being formed to carry out these roles as the Navy's premier strike aircraft.
Yeah. And you had the opportunity to speak to aircrew in writing this book. There's not many left, sadly. But what sort of memories do they have of operating the aircraft?
A big variation in memories. It's fair to say it was a Marmite aircraft for the aircrews. Some of them really liked it. Some of them absolutely hated it. There was no real division in terms of what the crew positions were. So some tags liked it, some didn't like it, some pilots liked it, didn't like it. One pilot I spoke to was very keen on it and said he actually aerobatted it, strictly against regulations. Others were aware of its shortcomings and its strengths, and in the typical way of the fleet air arm, actually were... They were focused on what the aircraft could do well, where its shortcomings were, and developing their tactics and training to suit those characteristics. So, you'd have people who would tell you it was a death trap, others that it was absolutely fine.
But the knowledge that you've got about this aircraft, a wonderful, wonderful book, great photos that are unpublished. So if you've got an interest in the Second World War and a Navy flight, there's some unique photography in there. How would you sum up the service of the Barracuda?
Underrated, I think. Flawed but successful. It was the aircraft the fleet air arm needed in those last years of war, and it's a shame it wasn't in service 1 or 2 years earlier, when it could have really benefited from its ability as a torpedo aircraft, which was used a little bit in the North Sea against German convoys and German shipping supplying Norway. But mostly its strike service was as a dive bomber. It was an effective anti-submarine aircraft, and actually later in the war and after the war helped develop the anti-submarine tactics that would be used in the Cold War and up to the present day. Flawed, but successful despite that, a workhorse, but a bit of a hero to me, really.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about we're in the hangar, in the restoration hangar at the Fleet Air Arm Museum, and there's just one question I want to ask you about the restoration, because I'm going to go and see Dave Morris in a short while. As a piece of kit that you came across that you've facilitated come into the restoration, if we can just walk over, can you tell me what this actually is? Because it looks like a grey box trucks to me, but it probably was one that my dad and Derek Armson and people like that were very familiar with.
Yeah, certainly Derek would have been, and he talked to me a lot about the torpedo training that they did. This is a it's the bulk, it's the large part of a torpedo director type F. So this box here is the computer type F. As you say, it's a grey box. It has a couple of windows in it with dials. What this bit of kit was for, it was an analog computer that enabled the pilot or the observer to direct the torpedoes to attack enemy shipping. So this was no longer something that pilots had to do a calculation in their head or using a rudimentary sight like the swordfish would have used. They could actually use this machine to set the course of the ship, the speed of the ship, the wind speed, and that would then set the course of the torpedo through the gyroscopes and enable them to approach at speed, with varying speed, course, altitude, and compensate for that. Yeah. So it's actually a fascinating bit of equipment that was central to the Barracuda's role as a torpedo bomber.
Yeah, and there's not much equipment left around the world that we know about for the Barracuda. This was a unique find. How did you come across this?
It was through the research for the book. Came across someone who had as part of their collection and were showing this on an ordnance collector's forum. So mostly other stuff on the forum was weapons of various kind, but this chap had a collection of naval aircraft equipment, and unfortunately he died before I could make contact with him regarding the book, but I was then contacted by the person who was disposing of his collection, then was able to facilitate its acquisition by the project.
Right, well I'm very keen to see it sit in the aircraft when it's finished, of course. Two personal questions then. I think everyone knows, declared here, that my dad flew in the Barracudas. When I read the book, one of the things that it didn't cover and I needed to ask you about was, he tells me a story about them coming into approach with the aerial down, which was a long trailing aerial, which dragged over the fence, and he said could have killed someone and probably got them court-martialed. You don't cover that in book. What was he talking about?
Right, so the radio that the Fleet Air Arm typically used was a high-frequency radio rather than the VHF that the RAF tended to use. This was more reliable over longer range. They had various bands that of frequencies that they would use. Most of these used the fixed aerials on the aircraft with the mast, stretched to the tail fin, you're familiar with from building your airfix kits. The trailing aerial was used for particular frequencies that required long range communication between the aircraft and the ship or aircraft and the shore base. So there would be a winch, it would be a cable with a weight on the end, and they would wind out this something like 100 odd feet long. This would trail in the air and would provide a much a better aerial for long-range communications. But as you say, the problem with this is you've got to make sure that you've got the thing wound in before you attempt to land. And there were stories of tags who would be fined for the cost of the weights, which would invariably get lost, and they'd be sent out onto the airfield to look for them. There's one story where in training, the pilot says to the trainee tag, "You know about thumbs up and thumbs down?" And the tag was thinking to himself, "Well, of course I do. Everyone knows that." So they went up in the aircraft, and the tag asked the pilot on over the Gosport tube, "Okay to lower the aerial." The pilot put his thumbs down. So the tag thinks, obviously, no, I can't lower the aerial yet. So he's sitting there waiting while the pilot's flying around, waiting for him to get permission to lower the aerial. The pilot puts his thumb up. So he lowers out the aerial, only to discover with horror they're just coming into land. Of course, it turns out thumbs down means wind down your aerial, thumbs up means wind up your aerial, which he found out too late. So I wonder if it was a similar situation with you that your dad got into.
I wonder if it was my dad, and you're being very kind there.
No, I can confirm it wasn't. It was a chap called Ken Sims, who used to be involved in the Tags Association, who wrote a fascinating book called Telegraphist Air Gunner, which is highly recommended for people who are interested in that role in the Navy. But
I've not read that book. I must get a copy.
Yeah.
One final question, Matt, and it's one I don't know if you can answer or not, but the Barracuda was powered by a Rolls-Royce Merlin. Did it sound the way we are so familiar in terms of that sort of Merlin growl?
The simple answer is yes, but there's a caveat to that. I've got a recording of a Barracuda Merlin, which I will try and share with you. It's on a 7-inch record. Now, the Barracuda DP872 that's in the Fleet Air Arm Museum being restored has the typical exhaust stubs that you're used to. Actually, I think they were ones that were borrowed from a Lancaster.
Okay.
Separate exhaust stubs. Another one of the little development problems that we talked about earlier that the Barracuda had was with its exhaust, and it went through probably something like 10 or 15 different exhaust layouts to try and get one that was had the correct flame damping for night flying, CO2 dispersal, and would not burn through, which the first configuration had a sort of a single long tube that was in a fairing in the fuselage that was sort of aerodynamically developed. So it's quite possible that the Barracudas with that exhaust setup would have sounded distinctly different to the ones we're familiar with. The ones that were later in service probably sounded much like your Spitfires and Hurricanes.
Yeah. Okay. Finally, where can we find the book? Where can we find out about it, Matt?
The book is published by MMP Books, which is Mushroom Model Publications. It's available through the publisher's website, which is mmpbooks.biz. It's also available on Amazon and through the Aviation Bookshop and various other all good bookshops.
Now, Matt, you know your stuff. I love coming and asking silly questions of you, but you've got a good social media presence as well. Where can we find you online?
Right, I'm at Naval Air History on Twitter. My website is navalairhistory.com, and Facebook, facebook.com/airandseastories.
Right, Matt, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for talking to me.
Matt, of course, there, fantastic knowledge on everything naval aviation, but a fantastic interview learning a bit more about the Fairey Barracuda. Now, it is pretty unknown, and the book that Matt has written has got lots and lots, over 150 photographs of the aircraft. It's highly detailed, not only in the graphics, but also in the technical aspects of the aircraft. So I believe for those modellers out there, this would be a great catch. But if you want to know about that aircraft and a little bit more, I would recommend Matt's book. He does go into a lot of detail. If you're technically minded and interested in this era of aviation, it would be a great book to have. So thanks again, Matt. Now, before we go on to hear my father's interview, I'd just like to play a few segments for some organisations we support here at Extended. Now, although you often get to hear some of these adverts, we receive no income from these organisations. We're there to help support them, and likewise, hopefully, they will help to promote us. So they are all really important to us. So please do not skip these. Listen through, and where you can, support these organisations.
This is Max Flight. I love aviation podcasts. That's why I do Airplane Geeks, the UAV Digest, and the PaxX podcast. But when I need a break from creating my own shows, I turn to Extended. Peter, Tim, and Gareth do a stellar job and bring us all interesting and informative episodes. Extended, a great aerospace program.
Navy Wings brings together flying historic naval aircraft, people, and the stories associated with flying from warships at sea. Navy Wings aims to inspire future generations and to create a focus for remembrance. You can support Navy Wings by becoming a supporter, making a donation, or becoming a volunteer. Find out more at www.navywings.org.uk. Listed in the Sunday Times top 10 geeky holiday spots on the planet, no other single location in the world has contributed so much to the development of aeronautical science over such a long period of time, and that is of course Farnborough.
The aircraft we do have all have our XREE experimental aircraft. So the Jaguar we have did an enormous amount of work on head-up displays. The Hunter we have did all the low-level FLIR work. The Puma we have was an experimental Puma, structural experimental flying Puma here. And the Nat was a structural test aircraft. The Harrier T2 we've got was a EMC, electromagnetic compatibility aircraft.
You can see all of these at the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum. And the greatest thing about the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum is it's free. Go and visit them at airsciences.org.uk to find out more. And if you can get to the south of England, you shouldn't miss this.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups, which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the Society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures, and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Not another flying magazine. The newsagents are stuffed with them. How can the aviation historian possibly be any different from the rest? Well, for a start, it's not a monthly, but a quarterly. It's compact format, not the usual A4, so it's great for reading in bed, in the bog, or in the bath. It doesn't cover the same old subjects, but tells you stuff you didn't already know. It's designed simply so it's easier to read, with no fussy backgrounds or overlapping images. And it's not in the newsagents at all. So check the website, theaviationhistorian.com, for more info. The Aviation Historian. It really is different from the rest.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
So the whole connection to this story is through the Ferry Barracuda and my father, who was a telegraphist air gunner. And a telegraphist air gunner did exactly what it said on the tin, really. He flew in the Barracuda, operating the radio, assisting with navigation, and of course manning the armament, the defensive armament in the Barracuda. I got the opportunity a long time ago now to record an interview for the Airplane Geeks. And what you're going to hear now is an extended version of that interview. It's about double the length. It includes some non-flying activities, but I hope puts into perspective his life during the end of the Second World War and how passionate he was about being part of a crew and being a member of the Royal Navy team. So here's my dad's interview. Today's segment is a story of an 18-year-old boy who joined the Royal Navy towards the end of the Second World War to fly as a telegraphist air gunner. Born on the 18th of August 1925, Anthony Kenneth Johnson had already valiantly served in the ARP, the Air Raid Precaution Team, and he'd been rescuing people from bombed buildings during the Blitz. Growing up as a child performer on the stage and on the screen, his story is even more amazing as he comes in the top group of the Telegraphist Air Gunners trainees and is sent to Canada to complete his training. This is my dad's story. Today I'm with Anthony Johnson, Petty Officer and Telegraphist Air Gunner. So you volunteered to join the Navy when you were 17, and you went in when you were 18.
That's correct.
And how did your training start?
Well, it was quite interesting, because I got my papers, and Nanny and Paul took me to the station with tears in her eyes, and not having been farther than Brighton before, I was all of a gog ready to go. Because on the papers, and my railway warrant, it said HMS Royal Arthur. So we got on the train, and there were other, obviously, would-be trainees going with us. And when we got to Skegness, we got off, and there was this lorry with tarpaulin over it. We all got on the lorry, great expectations, and it went along the seafront, and there was the sea, which I hadn't seen since Brighton days, and we were looking for the battleship, or whatever it was, HMS Skegness. Then all of a sudden, it turned into HMS Royal Arthur Butlins Holiday Camp.
And so you started your flying training with the Air Training Corps, and your first flight was in a Tiger Moth.
That's right, that's correct, in Southend. I always remember it was quite exhilarating and everything like that. And they taught me a lot in the ATC. The difficulty was, to go a little bit before that, I was working in a factory in Wood Lane, and it happened to be Fairy Factory, and that happened to make albacores, parts for the Spitfires, and Barracudas. Little did I know I was making things that perhaps I'd fly in later. I was doing riveting. Although I was only 14, they asked me, would I do night work? Which was completely illegal, but that's the war. And my mother said, well, if you want to do it, she always used to back me. That's one good thing, she always used to back me. So there was I, on night work, doing riveting of Spitfire frames, Barracudas, and bits of albacore, during the Blitz. And I was in, because it was night work, they only had a skeleton staff on, and there was I, in this great big huge shed, all by myself, and flashes of light, in, which were aircraft, anti-aircraft guns, because near, as it was near Wood Lane, they had a naval aircraft gun on wheels, going up and down, firing randomly in the air. I don't know whether they ever hit anything, but that didn't deter me. I used to quietly get away and do my work and get a bit of bonus on the side and everything like that. I was earning quite good wages at a particular time. And when Nanny said, well, did you have a good week? I said, oh yes, rattling my wage pack in my pocket. Because at one time she used to ask me for a wage packet. But when the money started going up, I decided that I I would have a share of this. And I used to buy fantastic things, like second-hand trumpets, which I couldn't play, and all sorts of things. But there you go. We went to Skegness. We did initial training there. And then we went on, I think it was a few weeks there, about 3 or 4 weeks, learned our left foot from our right foot and not walk with my left hand with my right hand at the same time, or my left foot with my left hand. We went to HMS St. Vincent, which was in Gosport. And there you had the basics of flying. And then because I was going to be an air gunner, telegraphist air gunner, you had to learn the basics of telegraphy, electron theory, electromagnetic theory, and so on.
And what made you choose being a telegraphist air gunner?
Well, it just appealed to me and everything, because I'd seen a poster which was in the Picture Post, and it had this picture of the telegraphist air gunner with his flying helmet on, with his machine gun pointing to the sky. And I thought that looked a good old job, firing out in the blue. So I decided for that.
And once you'd done your training in Gosport, you went off to Canada.
Yeah, but before that, I'd like to tell you a little story. Because I was on a course with people who've been to university and higher education, my education hadn't been all that great, because when I was younger, I was doing films and stage shows, and my schooling wasn't as good as I would have liked it. So what happened when we had the first week, we had magnetism and electron theory, which was way above my head. I didn't even know what they were talking about. In other words, when we were writing notes, I was sort of half a page behind. When we had our first exam, I was called into the commander's office and said, Airman Johnson, you have set a record. And I thought, oh, that's good. He said, yes, you set a record for the lowest marks there's ever been, which happened to be about 20 out of 100. So my legs started quaking. And he said to me, but your other things, like semaphore, he said, and telegraphy, Morse sending, is excellent. So he said, what I'm going to do is give you another chance. And I more or less said, please, sir, please, sir. And away I went. And that shook me up, because I knew I'd let my father down. He was so proud of me going in the Fleet Air Arm. And it taught me something, that from that day on, and all to the rest of my life, even today, I try always to do the best I can. Perhaps sometimes I haven't achieved this, but I can always say I've tried.
So they gave you another chance.
Yeah, having been taught the lesson, I decided, you know, I was going to pull my socks off, metaphorically. And every evening, myself and my three chums on the course used to go into the classroom, pick up the chalk, go to the blackboard, go all over the circuits and test each other. What is this? How do you get that? And learn that V equals I over R, and R equals I over V, and so on and everything like that. And so when that finished, we had an exam, and you couldn't crib then, because they used to have all the petty officers and officers going round. I was walking along, shaking, not knowing the result, and my school teacher, or schoolmaster, who was a warrant officer, I was passing him, and he said to me, Airman Johnson? I told him, yes, sir. He said, good show, very good show. You did make the effort. And I knew that I'd passed. And that meant that when we got the results, the top part of the course were going to Canada, and the bottom half, those who were on the bottom half of the course, went to Worthy Down, which I believe is in Sussex. Or yes, I think it's in Hampshire or somewhere like that. And we were due off to Canada.
So you got to go to the Royal Navy Telegraphist Air Gunner School at Great Yarmouth.
That's right. Going through America first and at Yarmouth.
And you went on a interesting trip, didn't you?
Oh, we got to... Before we went, actually, it was up in past Dunbroth or something like that. Or Arbroath or somewhere like that. I forget now. And my father always said, you wouldn't get seasick if you drink some seawater before you get on the ship. So I looked down before we were going on the ferry to the ship, and the water looked like it came out of sewer. There was all fag end boxes and this, that and the other, bits of straw. But I pushed them aside. I got cut my hand and drank some of the seawater. And I must say, I was never seasick afterwards. Anyway, we looked out in the harbour and there was this grey ship with, I believe, two funnels at the time. And they said, do you know what that is? Which turned out to be the Queen Elizabeth.
We send forth upon her mission this noble ship.
Well, we went over on the ferry to the Queen Elizabeth, got on board, and we were taken down below. We were quite surprised because the ship was nearly empty. There was only our course and a few other wads trailing around, completely empty. And they obviously they'd brought American troops over and was going back to America. And of course, then they were going to pick up supplies. So that was good for us, because we never seen, for instance, breakfast, a big trays of bacon and eggs, which people hadn't seen, and the food was absolutely terrific.
Is that because it was American, or?
Yeah, because it was American. Of course, we were, they used to, what we call victuals, which means, you know, stuffing up with food, in America. Which, I mean, more or less was non-ration. And, oh, it was so lovely. The ship was empty and you had these lovely staircases going up and the glass, all pink glass, which we'd more or less never seen before, with all carved things on it. It was lovely. And lo and behold, because the American gun crews were so tired going backwards and forwards on the thing, they put us on watch. Well, I'd never been near a gun before, and there were we standing there. I don't know what inch gun it was, whether it was a 2.5, 4.5, or what inch gun, but it was a blooming big gun. And there were we at night reporting the North Star as enemy aircraft and all sorts of things like that. It was complete chaos. How we weren't sunk, I don't know. But the ship was so fast. I mean, the record, I think, before the war, at the beginning of the war, was 5 days. Well, we were only on the ship 5.5. And it was zigzagging because the other destroyers, and they knew that submarines couldn't pick us up because they were going so fast, because submarines are limited to about 8 knots or 12 knots underneath.
So you crossed to New York.
And we arrived at New York.
The 84,000 ton liner Queen Elizabeth enters New York Harbor as a Navy blimp.
And we got on the train to New Jersey. And we stayed there for a few days. And from New Jersey, we got on a train and went via various Boston and God knows what. To Nova Scotia and the end of the line.
So you're training in at Yarmouth, and so you went from no flying to flying, gunnery practice, radio practice.
That's right. And some very interesting things happened, because the airfield was huge. So huge, we were on the what they call the east side, and I believe the west side was RCAF, the Royal Canadian Air Force. And you can get an idea how big the airfield was, because they had these Catalina flying boats from the other side. And we had Swordfish, Avro Andersons and Avro Oxfords over there where we did our training.
So what was your first flight in a Swordfish like?
Well, in a Swordfish, you had to hold everything down, because you had what they call a G-string, and that clipped on the back of your harness. And some idiots never used to clip this on. So when the pilot decided to do flips and God knows what, they nearly went over the side. But I was made sure I was always clipped in. But the thing was, there was a chap called Sergeant Silk, and he was a Royal Canadian Air Force pilot that was seconded to our base. And he was a very venturesome chap. I believe he'd been sent back to Canada because he was incorrigible when he was over in England. And he was sent back. They sort of punished him. And he used to do all sorts of things. He used to try as hard to somersault an Avro Anson. And if you ever see an Avro Anson, you know that was disastrous.
So he would try and spin one?
Oh, he'd try and spin one. And one day, there used to be two of us. Alphabetically, they used to pair us off. And Holston and Johnson. And there were two Johnsons, but I used to fly with Holston. He was in one seat in the plane, and I was on usually on the back seat of the plane. And we were tapping away. In my flying log that I've got there, you had to do your position every quarter of an hour or 20 minutes. Send it through where your position was. One day we were flying around, and we both looked up, and Holston nearly jumped out of his chair, because there was the pilot, Sergeant Sick, going down to the rear of the plane.
And they didn't have autopilots?
Yes, they did have autopilot. We didn't know it was an autopilot. So, you know, he saw us looking very dazed and bewildered. He said, "Go and take over." And I got up. I didn't know what I was doing and sat in the pilot seat. He came behind me. He said, "Put your feet in the stirrups." He said, "And there's the control column." He said, "Now fly." And there was me, petrified, holding the stick forward. He leapt forward and said, "No, do this." And then he touched me with his feet. His feet touched mine. And there we were flying and doing side slips and God knows what. And be sitting in the pilot seat, petrified.
So you got some pilot in command time.
That's right.
Can you just tell us what a telegraphist air gunner does?
Well, in the Swordfish, you had a pilot, an observer, and a telegraphist air gunner. Yeah, obviously, the air gunner was a gunner. And he looked round. He had this gun, which was a Vickers gas-operated gun, which was useless, you know. But there again, one of the chaps apparently shot down one of the first planes of the war. And he was either in a skewer or a Swordfish. And one of the telegraphist air gunners shot, I think it was a Messerschmitt 9, down at the beginning of the war. So it wasn't completely useless.
You had the role as a gunner, but also the telegraphist air gunner. So that's radio and navigation.
Radio, and you had a Wurlitzer set, which was diabolical. And you had coils which you had to put in, and you had to know what certain coils you have, and you had to know to let your aerial out, because we used to work on lower frequencies. The Americans later worked on higher frequencies, which was wonderful. And I'll tell you about that later, because when we went over to Barracudas, we used to have what they call crystal calibrated sets. And they were hand calibrated. So when you got a frequency, you knew it was dead on. But with the frequency you got, you trailed the trailing area about 100 yards of training aerial, and they had lead beads on the end which flew out the back, and you had to be very, very careful it didn't get in what they call the oleo wheel, and that was the back wheel. So you always had to tell the pilot when it was reeled in.
And in Yarmouth, you flew the Swordfish and the Barracuda?
No, the Barracudas weren't there. It was Swordfish. They didn't have any albacores there. They had Swordfish, Avro Anson and Oxfords.
And what was it like? Everyone will want to know what it's like to sit in the back seat of a Swordfish.
Very, very cold. You used to get what they call silk gloves, because to put on your hands. Well, if you ever tried to write with silk gloves and tap out Morse, it's diabolical. So nobody ever used to wear them. They used to wear the silk scarf you was given, because it always used to look smart. Silk scarf flying behind you. And you've seen the photograph of me in full flying suit. That was the only time I ever wore it.
So it must have been pretty uncomfortable up there.
Uncomfortable. But you can just imagine that flying suit trying to move around in a very confined cockpit. So nobody used to wear it.
How high did you fly in the Swordfish?
Oh, I don't know. It depended on what pilot you got. I mean, it was very good. The higher you flew, the better the signal, because you learned all about the Heaviside layer and the Appleton layer. That's ozones above the Earth. And you got better signals, because you, as I say, you had to do these signals every quarter of an hour.
And you got to do your gunnery practice in Yarmouth. What was it like firing for the first time?
Well, what they used to... Everyone was looking forward to this. And what they used to have a Swordfish that used to have what they call a drogue. That's like a windsock, a big windsock. And they used to let it out with a long length of line, so that any gunner who... We all had good eyesight, because you had to pass the eyesight test. But who was a little bit flimsy on the trigger didn't shoot their tail plane off. And there's a very interesting story about guns. We had a course petty officer who taught us about guns. I forget his name now, whether it was Kelly or whatever it was. But he had this fearsome beard, and a little story about him. Apparently, he came down in the desert. I think their plane, the Swordfish, was shot down, and he captured the Italians who tried to capture him. And I believe he got a medal. I don't know whether it was the British Empire medal or something like that. But he was a fearsome petty officer, and everyone was frightened of him. And there was a story about him I'd like to tell you. With guns, in the end, I turned out to be an ace-hot sharpshooter with the guns. But with a shotgun, I couldn't hit the side of a wall. And why that was, I don't know. So one day, I was trying to hit this skeet, and this petty officer said to me, "Johnson!" So I turned round to him with the gun and pointed at his stomach. He said, "Drop that so-and-so gun," I won't say what he said, "and double round the airfield." Well, I don't know whether I've already told you, but the airfield was as big as Heathrow. And all I heard him, when I was about 100, 200 yards away, "I said double." A quarter of a mile away, I heard his voice say, "I said double." Well, as I said, it was a large airfield. This was before lunch, and I arrived right round the other side, just as they were setting up for tea. And that taught me something, that always, when I've seen somebody point a gun, even if it's a water pistol at someone, I've always told them, never point a gun. I think I've told you, because I never used to buy you guns. But I've always thought, never point a gun. Even the other day, there was someone pointing a gun, an air gun, at somebody in the paper. And the article was in the paper, and they shot him in the eye or something.
So you were in Canada until 1944, and then you came back to the UK to 713 Squadron?
Yeah, and I begged him, can I go on the operational squadron? And it must have sort of rattled in their ear, because I was on 713 squadron, and I was an instructor. And I did, that's all might be all right for some, but I wanted to get an operation. So eventually, I ended up in the Isle of Man, and we had what they call crewing up, where pilots had their observers, chose their observers, and they chose their air gunners. And Sub-Lieutenant Anderson was the pilot, Butler was the observer, and they chose me.
Yeah, I saw Anson as your pilot in your logbook an awful lot in the Barracudas.
That's right. And so we was assigned to Barracudas. And it was what they call a semi... at that time, we were on 713, and it was semi-operational. And what that means is you're preparing to go on an operational squadron. And they had Wrens also on the ground crew there.
Very nice.
Yeah, well, up to a point, because one of the Wrens, we were preparing to do what they call night operation, where we drop magnesium bombs. Well, we were in the changing room, putting on our flying boots, and there was this huge bang and the smell of cordite and smoke. We all rushed out, and there was this Wren lying on the floor, and all you could see, bottom of a trousers had been blown off, and all you could see was the bones, lower bones of her leg and flesh. And what she should have done was put this magnesium bomb under the Barracuda's wing. Well, Barracuda's wings are very high, like parasol wings, very high off the ground. Now, to do that, she should have stood on the chocks or something like that, and make sure, or a ladder, or anything like that. But something which she could have taken with her feet and get a proper stance on. But unfortunately, whether she stood on a chop and slipped, I don't know. But what she did was take out the safety pin and try and put it in the rack. What she should have done was put it in the rack and take out the safety pin. She staggered, dropped it just in front of her legs, the bomb.
So, from 713 Squadron with Anson, you did your bombing practice and so forth. What was that like, dropping bombs?
Well, that was quite interesting, because day and night they had what they call a leeward weight, which was like, I would say, nearly as big as this room, a sort of platform which they pulled behind a ship. And this used to go, as it was pulled along on the cable, it used to go up and down under the waves and come up, just like perhaps a submarine would. And then you bombed it as a submarine. You bombed it with these bombs. In daytime, you would just bomb it with these bombs that used to go off. At night, you want to see where the bombs go, so you used to use the magnesium bombs. So coming back, this was the daytime, I saw the Barracuda we were in coming down, and I looked out, and we're getting ready to land. And I'd had about 200 or 300 feet of training area, like a cheese wire with all these lead balls on the end. And all of a sudden, crash, it went across, because there was a road at the side where you landed in the Isle of Man. A lot of people will know this, because TT races. And there was my training area going through bushes and everything and wrapping itself around the rear wheel leg of
is that in your logbook? You've got an incident where the rear wheel collapsed. Is it because of that?
Yeah. And I said, I don't know whether I put this in my logbook or whether that was another time, but anyway, I was sweating because that is a cheese cutter. If anyone's seen how wire cuts cheese, this did. And if anyone had been going past on this road, it would have just sliced through them. Of course, we got out and looked at the leg, and I thought, somebody's going to be court-martialed over this, because that's a court-martial offence. And he said, my pilot said, well, you know, I should really have waited. We sort of said, well, you should have waited for me to ride it in, rather than saying, you know, going to land, and I couldn't get time to wind the thing in. So we're all sweating on the top line. We got away from that.
We are the boys who will stop your little game. We are the boys who will make you think again.
And the Barracuda, what was that like to fly in? Was it a nice stable plane or?
It was a death trap. In the Isle of Man, they were doing bombing practice, and a friend of mine who was on the course with me, he was the air gunner on it, and they went, the wing folded back and it went straight in.
And why did the wing fold back?
Well, as usual, they said, well, you know, the catch on the wing couldn't have been clipped safely. But after the war, and in one of my magazines, they made a mention that the strap they were using clipped the wing in and made it safe. They were using inferior metal. Apparently, had been used. So this could have been the case where the metal snapped.
And the wings folded on the Barracuda, so literally it folded in flight.
Yeah, the wing folded and everything. And then, of course, you've got no chance. You go straight in.
And so then you got to go to an operational squadron, which was 822 squadron?
That's right. And because squadrons have been taken off aircraft carriers, we went to RAF base. And the reason for that was that in Slapton Sands, the Americans, before D-Day, were making simulated landings with their landing boats, and they went out from the coast, and the English destroyers and the American destroyers unfortunately were on a different frequency. As usually happens, there's always some mess up somewhere and you usually can get over it, but this time the E-boats, for some unknown reason, knew about this, and they were picking the landing boats off one by one. And this was all hushed up. There had been programs on the television about this, so we learned of this later. But there were many, many of the Americans killed, quite a lot.
And so the landing craft and the aircraft carriers, a lot of the Navy squadrons were put on RAF land bases.
And that's right, what they call ASBU, anti-small battle units. Well, we didn't mind, because you come on more or less RAF discipline rather than Navy discipline, which is always different. And also, the Lord Nuffield Trust used to give operational air crews 7 packets of barley sugar, 7 pieces of chewing gum, apple, oranges and bananas, which the normal public couldn't get.
And was the discipline different between the RAF and the Navy?
Completely different. I mean, you try to walk around in the Navy on a carrier or anything like that with your flying boots on, your scarf on, and an Irving jacket on, swaggering around, you wouldn't get far. You'd be on commander's report or something like that. But in there, you could.
So 822 Squadron was doing coastal command activities. What sort of things were you doing?
We had to look out because they thought that 1- and 2-man submarines, they'd heard about it, obviously, from either the French resistance, that they were trying to build these things. And also, E-boats were hovering around. So, they were laying mines, and we had to look out for mines. I managed to have a good few shots at mines when we were flying around and everything like that. I don't think I ever sunk one, but I had a good go.
You also used to patrol down by the Channel Islands.
That's right, on the Channel Islands. And obviously it wasn't in our permit to fly over the Channel Islands.
Because they were occupied by the Germans.
Although Europe, parts of Europe were no longer occupied, they were. So when we used to flip round and get nearer that nice little fort that was on the beach, he used to say to the pilot, by the way, have you noticed them ripples down by the starboard wing? And there was, they used to fire these Oerlikon cannons. And because we were about 100 feet off the sea, you could see the ripples coming up.
So the Germans were firing at you?
Oh, yeah. I later visited the fort where the Oerlikon cannons were on. I mean, obviously, it's still there, the fort. They used to take pot shots of this. And we didn't actually put our fingers up to our nose. But we really shouldn't have done that, tempt them and everything like that.
And did you ever fire back?
No, because if you did, you might be hitting civilians in Jersey. You know, you tempted, it was a nice little target, but if you started firing back, you would get, you might take a few civilians out. So you never did.
And from your logbook, around this time, you were flying Ansons, Swordfish and Barracudas.
No, just Barracudas.
Just Barracudas.
Because that was in Canada where we did all that. Our squadron, by the time we got on it, they got rid of the Swordfish and we were on these Barracudas. And it was quite nice going on Dawn Patrol because... what we used to do is go in the canteen and there was nice bacon and eggs served up by the Italians who used to be prisoner of wars. But that time, they, you know, Italy had given up. But they still went around. And a lot of the Wrens, of course they were Italian, had liaisons with them. And we used to have our bacon and eggs and go on Dawn Patrol.
And so you came to the end of your service, the war ended. And you carried on serving until June 1946?
That's right. They wanted me to stop in. They asked me specially. I was at Leon Sound at the time. And they asked me specially whether I wanted to stay in. Not only was the Hammersmith Pally calling me, dance hall, but my mother was also, because she said, look after Pearl, who was in the Ballinegri. And Pearl said to me, there's a new dance group coming on. And I was on leave, so he said, would you like to see it? It's a new theory. Did you do spontaneous dancing to music to an African orchestra? There is a story, but there's certain musical cues. Anyway, I went to rehearsals, and I was quite interested. I wanted to stay in the Fleet Era, but anyway, they put my arms behind my back and and said, well, you know, look after Paul, come out. It's forces.
And you left as a petty officer. And right. What decorations did you have?
I had, eventually, because if you flew for 6 months in the operational squadron, you could get the 1939 and 1945 star, the France and Germany, the Defence Medal, and the Victory Medal. The last two I would got anyway because I was in the ARP before I went in.
And so some of your memories are fond ones and some not so fond. What do you take from all of that?
Oh, I learned a lot. I learned about camaraderie. I learned about always trying to do your best at the time. And the greatest thing, I think, was I made my father proud. And he was very, very proud because in all my service in the Navy at that particular time, although I must point out in Nelson's time, quite a lot of the people who fought in Trafalgar were coloured. You can see this in one of the paintings in the Tate Gallery. One of the sailors was kneeling by Nelson as he was dying.
So what was it like being a black individual in the Navy at that time?
Well, absolutely nothing. They accepted that there are no problems. The only problem I had was we were going to the top half, of course. I said, goes to Canada, and the bottom half was going to Worthing. But then I was in the top half of the course. I was going to Canada. And that time, I believe there were trouble in Detroit with riots and all sorts of things. So I went in front of the commander to ask to be taken off course and go to Worthy Down. And he refused. And he said, Airman Johnson, he said, I refuse. He said, now what I will tell you, you go over there, you're wearing the British uniform. He said, and show them not only that you're our equal, but you're our better. Request refused. On caps, about turn, out to go.
Well, Dad, we're all very proud of you. We're all very proud of what you did.
Oh, that's great. That's great. The thing that I always loved the Navy, and even now, I go around, I've got my badge on my blazer, and I go around with my baseball cap with my wings on the top. And I'm always so proud when somebody asks me, because when I walk along the street, Mr. Joe Britton is not going to know whether I come from Nigeria or whether I come from Jamaica. But when I open my mouth and they hear my voice, they know I'm a Cockney and I come from London.
Well done, Dad.
Thanks very much.
But the story didn't finish there, and I had the opportunity, through sheer luck and through the work that I'd done on podcasting from that passion that my dad had created, to find his pilot. And this was a short follow-up to my dad's interview. Again, care of the Airplane Geeks. A few months ago, something quite incredible happened to me. As many of you know, my passion for aviation stems from my father, who flew in World War II in the Royal Navy Fleet Air Arm. We even managed to get some of his stories out before he left us a while ago. Much of what I do now, I owe to my dad. But there was much more to find out from him about his flying days, and although we tried very hard, the one thing Dad never managed to do, even with the blessing of modern technology, was to find his good friend and colleague from the war, his regular pilot, sub-lieutenant Derek Armson. It's a familiar name to me, as I see it so many times in Dad's logbook. He served with Sub-Lieutenant Armson for almost 2 years. A week before Christmas, in my email inbox, I received an email from Derek. He'd managed to track me down because of my work with the Airplane Geeks Extended and Plane Crazy Down Under. My profile and the links to my father's story had finally made the connection. I spent an hour talking to Derek on the phone and sharing some of the stories and experiences, second-hand from my dad, but first-hand from Derek. We were so excited that we'd managed to connect that we vowed to meet and record his side of the story and do what I'd done for the records with my dad and allow Derek to tell his tales. Being a long way from home, it was going to take some coordinating, and although we both swore to make this happen, I received the very sad news that Sub-Lieutenant Armson had lost his fight for life on Saturday the 9th of March after a short battle with illness. Although I never really knew Derek well enough, this brought a tear to my eye, not only because of course it reminds me of my dad, but because we've lost yet another hero from our midst. When I talked to Derek, we laughed at the stories we shared, and we tried to gain a better understanding when we talked of each other's circumstances and experiences within aviation. Yet there's one story that I'd never heard, and that was that one night when they were serving with, I think, 822 Squadron up in Royal Naval Air Station Ronald's Way, which of course we all now know as the Isle of Man Airport, Derek left with the gunner for a sortie in the Barracuda over the Irish Sea. Now, for some reason, Dad never went, even though he was part of that Barracuda crew and had always flown with Derek. And they always went on every sortie together. Derek can't even remember why either. But anyway, that's not the reason that I want to tell you this story. As fate would have it, the mighty Merlin engine failed them, and Derek had to ditch the Barracuda into the cold Irish Sea.
He managed to get a Mayday message out, but no one was tracking the flight, so they didn't know where to search. However, my dad, in his room, had been tracking the proposed route all along, and when he heard of the Mayday, he was able to track their course and speed and determine where he thought they might have gone down. It took 3 hours to get to the location Dad had suggested, and although near exhausted and near death, Derek and the gunner were rescued. They were where my dad said they would be. Derek's words to me were that my dad had saved his life, because no one else would have stayed on duty that night to track their flight except their own crew member and comrade. My father never told me or anyone else of this story, and I'm so grateful I had the chance to hear it. And I'm so sorry that Derek can't tell you his story as we'd hoped. But I'll see what I can do when I get the opportunity to go through some of his records and notes. And there's the possibility, along with my dad's files, that we can compile some stories to bring back to you. So in summary, another great loss. But that small time I had with Derek reminded me how brave those guys were back then, and how we should never forget them. If you're interested in finding out more about Derek and my dad and other Fleet Air Arm exploits in the war, then do follow Matt Willis at Naval Air History on Twitter and at his website navalairhistory.com, as Matt's going to be publishing his history of the Barracuda, and he'd interviewed Derek as well, so I'm sure Derek's input will come through. Our thoughts and our condolences go to Anne, Derek's wife, their family, and all their friends. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. A little bit different, a little bit more about me and how I managed to fall into back into love with aviation. But really, this is all about the Fairey Barracuda, that aircraft that my dad got to fly in hundreds of times. But also very, very nicely narrated book by Matt Willis, who's brought all of those experiences and those anecdotes to life for me through the detail that he's written in that book. So please do look that book up. Right, that's it for this episode. We'll be back very soon with some more content. I hope for those in the Northern Hemisphere, you're enjoying your holiday break. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. And remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
And my father always said, you wouldn't get seasick if you drink some seawater before you get on the ship. So I looked down before we were going on the ferry to the ship, and the water looked like it came out of sewer. I got cut my hand and drank some of the seawater. And I must say, I was never seasick afterwards.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need. Extended.
This is XTP Media.